To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
The time is 6:30, and we are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 Community Radio, and this is we just heard Labor Radio, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University, dedicated to helping working adults revitalize their careers by offering 5 part-time MBAs, including an MBA in healthcare management with evening, weekend, and online options. Listeners can learn more at the information session on Thursday, November 7th at 6:30. Details can be found online at merrillhurst.edu. Please stay tuned now for Prison Pipeline.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Close Guantanamo, a public forum featuring the past president of Veterans for Peace, Elliot Adams, plus Portland's Guantanamo Solidarity Vigilers. Close Guantanamo is co-sponsored by VFP Chapter 72 and the Economic Justice Action and Peace Action Groups of the First Unitarian Church of Portland. Adams will discuss different messages about why we will be better off when Guantanamo is closed from various perspectives. Christian, Muslim, Jewish, those concerned about national security, and the fiscally minded. Close Guantanamo will be at the Elliott Chapel, First Unitarian Church of Portland, on 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue, on November 7th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. More information about this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage, under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Visegrad Group PDX Festival, November 9th from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. To celebrate the 95th anniversary of independence of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian nations, this one-day festival will share traditions, history, arts and crafts, and national food of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian communities within Multnomah County. Again, the Visegrad Group PDX Festival will take place at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue, on Saturday, November 9th, from 1 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Tonight we'll hear excerpts from a talk by Angela Davis on feminism and abolition, given earlier this year at the University of Chicago. But first, Mumia Abu-Jamal's memorial message for revolutionary Herman Wallace.
Herman Wallace, revolutionary. The long and tortured life of Herman Wallace, of the famed Angola 3, was meant to terrorize us, to stifle the resistance that flamed throughout the black nation and many others across the country during the 60s and 70s. If so, it failed utterly. For Herman Wallace, former Black Panther, despite the monstrous torture he sustained of 41 years in the hold of Angola, I will not dignify it with the name prison, slave plantation, was one who was caged precisely because, in mind, if not in body, he was free. He was one of 3 men, his fellow ex-Panthers, Robert Hillary King and Albert Woodfox, the rest of the Angola 3, who exampled strength, determination, and will during their hellish times in Louisiana's wretched dungeons. I have used the word torture and I do not use it lightly. Juan Mendez, special rapporteur for the United Nations, has found that solitary confinement for any period past 14 days constitutes real psychological torture that destroys human beings. 14 days. Herman Wallace, convicted on trumped-up charges under poisonous Louisiana justice, spent 41 years in solitary, in Angola, in Louisiana, in the United States of America. 41 years. Let's put it another way. Herman Wallace spent 14,965 days in solitary. Herman Wallace spent 359,160 hours in solitary. When a federal judge tossed out his illegal and unconstitutional conviction, ordering his release, Herman Wallace, bedridden, spent 3 days in freedom until returning to his ancestors. His flesh is returned to the earth, our mother. But his spirit burns with strength and rock-solid commitment to freedom for us all. According to published reports, Herman's last words were, "I am free." But he always was. Herman's contribution to freedom, even while in the vilest dungeons in America, while in shackles and chains in Angola, was immense. If he were still present, he would urge us all not to forget his brother in chains, Albert Woodfox. For as the saying goes, freedom is a constant struggle. In the Black Panther Party, there was a saying, when an oppressor dies, it is lighter than a feather, but when a revolutionary dies, it is heavier than a mountain. Herman's death is heavier than a mountain, for he deserved far more than 3 days of freedom away from the stench of Angola and Louisiana justice. Yet his death, his suffering, his torture, his loneliness reminds all of us of the true nature of the system and the dark, monstrous features of the prison industrial complex, a complex of matchless cruelty and unbridled savagery. Herman, Albert, and Robert were subjected to such treatment because they courageously resisted and opposed such repression. They organized a chapter of the Black Panther Party while prisoners in Angola. They were targeted and tortured for engaging in, I kid you not, what the officials called Black Pantherism. So remember Herman's sacrifice. 41 years, 14,965 days, 359,160 hours, and his last words, "I am free." May we all live to find such freedom. I thank you all, and in the memory of Herman, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And let's visit the San Francisco Bay Area, where I live. And an organization that is called Transgender, Gender Variant, Intersex Justice Project. Now, TGI Justice Project is an organization led by women of color, by trans women of color. The executive director is a woman whose name is Miss Majors. She describes herself as a black, formerly incarcerated, male-to-female transgender elder. Born and raised on the south side of Chicago and a veteran activist, she participated in the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969. Their work is deeply feminist because they work at the intersection of race, class, sexuality, and gender, and because they move from addressing the individual predicaments of the members of their community who constitute the individuals who are most harassed by law enforcement, most arrested and incarcerated, and of course they end up primarily in male prisons, especially if they have not undergone gender reassignment surgery, and many of them don't want to undergo that surgery. And sometimes, even if they have undergone the surgery, they end up being placed in men's prisons. And after they are in prison, they often receive more violent treatment by the guards than anyone else. And on top of that, they are marked by the institution as targets of male violence. And this is so much the case that cops so easily joke about their sexual fate in male prison, in the male prisons where they're usually sent. Male prisons are represented as violent places. But we see, especially by looking at the predicament of trans women, that this violence is often encouraged by the institutions themselves. Many of you are familiar with the Minneapolis case of Cece McDonald, who was charged with murder after an encounter with a group that yelled out, okay, racist, homophobic, and transphobic slurs all at the same time. And she is now in a men's prison in Minnesota, serving a 3.5-year sentence. But on top of this violence, trans women are often denied their hormonal treatments, even if they have valid prescriptions. The point that I'm trying to make is that we learn a great deal about the reach of the prison system, about the nature of the prison industrial complex, about the reach of abolition by examining the particular struggles of trans prisoners and especially trans women. But perhaps most important of all, and this is so central to the development of feminist abolitionist theories and practices, we have to learn how to think and act and struggle against that which is ideologically constituted as normal. As normal. Prisons are constituted as normal. It takes a lot of work to persuade people to think beyond the bars and to be able to imagine a world without prisons and to struggle for the abolition of imprisonment as the dominant mode of punishment. And we can ask ourselves, in that context, why are trans women, and especially black trans women who cannot easily pass, why are they considered so far outside the norm? They're considered outside the norm by almost everyone in the society. And of course, we've learned a great deal about gender over the past decades. I suppose just about everyone who's in the field of feminist studies have read Judith Butler's Gender Trouble. But you should also read Beth Ritchie's most recent book, amazing book, which is called Arrested Justice, Black Women, Violence, and the Prison Nation. And specifically look at her account of the case of the New Jersey Four, where four young black lesbians just walking around having fun in Greenwich Village ended up in prison because they defended themselves from male violence, and then they saw themselves represented in the media as a lesbian wolf pack. And so we see that here race, gender, sexual nonconformity can lead to racist bestialization, which is an attack, as one of my students, Eric Stanley, points out in his dissertation, is an attack not only against the humans, but against the animals as well. TGIP shows us that these objects can become something entirely different as a result of our work. It shows us that we need to It shows us that the process of trying to assimilate into an existing category is in many ways runs counter to the whole effort to produce something radical or revolutionary. And it shows us that we should not try to assimilate trans women into a category that remains the same, but that the category itself has to change so it does not simply reflect normative ideas of who counts as women and who doesn't. But by extension, there's another lesson. By extension, the lesson is don't even become too attached to the concept of gender. Because as a matter of fact, the more closely we examine it, the more we discover that it is embedded in a range of social, political, cultural, and ideological formations. It is not one thing. There is not one definition. And certainly, gender cannot now be adequately described as a binary structure, with male being one pole and female at the other. And so bringing trans women, trans men, intersex, many other forms of gender nonconformity into the concept of gender, it radically undermines the normative assumptions of the very concept of gender. And I want to share with you this really wonderful quote from Dean Spade, whom I understand spoke yesterday. A central endeavor of feminist, queer, and trans activists has been to dismantle the cultural ideologies, social practices, and legal norms that say certain body parts determine gender identity and gendered social characteristics and roles. We continue to work to dispel myths that body parts somehow make us who we are and make us less than or better than, depending on which we may have. Now, trans scholar activists are doing, as I said, some of the most interesting work on prison abolition. And I just want to mention three recent books by scholar activists who engage with trans abolitionist politics. And one of them is a wonderful anthology edited by Eric Stanley and Nat Smith. Eric Stanley is the one I mentioned, was my student. And it's called Captive Genders, Trans Embodiment and the Prison Industrial Complex. And Andrea Ritchie, Kay Whitlock, and Joey Mogul recently published an anthology called Queer Injustice, the Criminalization of LGBT People in the United States. And then Dean Spade, whom I just recently quoted, it's called Normal Life: Administrative Violence, Critical Trans Politics, and the Law. Now, I would argue that all three of these texts are feminist, and feminist not so much because they address a feminist object, although racism, the prison industrial complex, criminalization, captivity, violence, and the law are all objects that feminism should analyze, criticize, and also resist through struggle. But I see these texts as being feminist primarily because of their methodologies. And feminist methodologies can assist us all in major ways as researchers, academics, and as activists and organizers. The assumption has been that because transgender and gender nonconforming populations are relatively small within a prison system, and therefore, why should they deserve very much attention? But feminist approaches to the understanding of prisons, and indeed the prison industrial complex, have always insisted that, for example, if we look at imprisoned women, who are also a very small percentage throughout the world, we learn not only about women in prison, but we learn much more about the system as a whole than we would learn if we looked exclusively at men. Thus, also a feminist approach would insist both on what we can learn from and what we can transform with respect to trans and gender non-conforming prisoners, but also it insists on what this knowledge and activism tell us about the nature of punishment writ large, about the very apparatus of the prison. It is true that we cannot begin to think about the abolition of prisons outside of an anti-racist context. It is also true that abolition embraces that prison abolition, anti-prison abolition, must also embrace the abolition of gender policing. And that very process reveals the epistemic violence, and the feminist studies students in here know what I'm talking about, the violence that is inherent in the gender binary in the larger society. So bringing feminism within an abolitionist frame, and vice versa, bringing abolition within a feminist frame, means that we take seriously the old feminist adage that the personal is political. The personal is political. Everybody remembers that, right? The personal is political. And we can follow the lead of Beth Ritchie in thinking about the dangerous ways in which the institutional violence of the prison complements and extends the intimate violence of the family, of the relationship, the individual violence of battery and sexual assault. We also question whether incarcerating individual perpetrators does anything more than reproduce the very violence that the perpetrators have allegedly committed. There is criminalization, but the problem persists. And it seems to me that people who are working on the front line of the struggle against violence against women, they should also be on the front line of abolitionist struggles. People opposed to police crime should be opposed to what is constructed as domestic violence. There's public violence and there's privatized violence. There's a feminist philosophical dimension of abolitionists, both abolitionist theories and practices. The personal is political. There is a deep relationality that links struggles against institutions and struggles to reinvent our personal lives and recraft ourselves. We know, for example, that we replicate the structures of retributive justice oftentimes in our own emotional responses. Someone attacks us, verbally or otherwise, our response is what? A counterattack. The retributive impulses of the state are inscribed in our very emotional responses. The political reproduces itself through the personal. This is a feminist insight, a Marxist-inflected feminist insight that perhaps reveals some influence of Foucault. This is a feminist insight regarding the reproduction of the relations that enable something like the prison industrial complex. Now, we recognize, or we should recognize, that the imprisoned population could not have grown to almost 2.5 million people in this country without our implicit assent. And we don't even acknowledge the fact that psychiatric institutions are often an important part of the prison industrial complex, nor do we acknowledge the intersection of the pharmaceutical industrial complex and the prison industrial complex. But the point that I make is that if we had mounted a more powerful resistance in the 1980s and in the 1990s during the Reagan-Bush era and during the Clinton era, we would not be confronting such a behemoth today. We have had to unlearn a great deal over the course of the last few decades. We have had to try to unlearn racism, and not only white people. People of color have had to unlearn the assumption that racism is individual, that it is primarily a question of individual attitudes that can be dealt with through sensitivity training. You remember Don Imus called the Rutgers women's basketball team nappy-headed hoes about 5 years ago. 5 years later, he's rehabilitated. But of course, this doesn't compensate for the fact that Troy Davis is dead, his life claimed by the most racist of all of our institutions, capital punishment. No amount of psychological therapy or group training can effectively address racism in this country unless we also begin to dismantle the structures of racism. And prisons are racism incarnate. As Michelle Alexander points out, they constitute the new Jim Crow, but also much more. As the linchpins of the prison industrial complex, they represent the increasing profitability of punishment. They represent the increasingly global strategy of dealing with populations of people of color and immigrant populations from the countries of the global south as surplus populations, as disposable populations. Put them all in a vast garbage bin. Add some sophisticated electronic technology to control them and let them languish there. And in the meantime, create the ideological illusion that the surrounding society is safer and more free because the dangerous black people and Latinos, the Native Americans, and the dangerous Asians, and the dangerous white people, and of course the dangerous Muslims, are locked up. And in the meantime, corporations profit and poor communities suffer. Public education suffers because it is not profitable according to corporate measures. Public health care suffers. If punishment can be profitable, then certainly, health care should be profitable too. This is absolutely outrageous. It is outrageous. It is also outrageous that the state of Israel uses the carceral technologies developed in relation to U.S. prisons not only to control the more than 8,000 Palestinian political prisoners in Israel, but also to control the Palestinian population. The separation wall and other carceral technologies are the material constructs of Israeli apartheid. G4S, you know the organization, the corporation G4S, which profits from the incarceration and the torturing of Palestinian prisoners. It has a subsidiary called G4S Secure Solutions, which was formerly known as Wackenhut. And just recently, a subsidiary of that corporation, Geo Group, which is a private prison company, attempted to claim naming rights at Florida Atlantic University by donating something like $6 million, right? And the students rose up. They said that our football stadium will not bear the name of a private prison corporation. And the students won. The name came down from the marquee. And so we can say from California or Texas or Illinois to Israel, and occupied Palestine, and then back to Florida. But we should not have allowed this to happen. We should not have allowed this to happen over the last three decades. And we cannot allow it to continue today. And let me say that I really love the new generations of young students and workers. And what I like most about the younger generation is that they are truly informed by feminism, even if they don't know it, or even if they don't admit it. They are informed by anti-racist struggles. They are not infected with the emotionally damaging homophobia which has been with us for so long. And they're taking the lead in challenging transphobia along with racism and Islamophobia. So I like working with young people because they allow me to imagine what it is like not to be so totally overburdened with decades of oppressive ideology. So I want to let Asata Shakur have the last word tonight. At this moment, she wrote a few years ago, "I am not so concerned about myself. Everybody has to die sometime, and all I want is to go with dignity. I am more concerned about the growing poverty, the growing despair that is rife in America. I am more concerned about our younger generations who represent our future. I am more concerned about the rise of the prison industrial complex that is turning our people into slaves again. I am more concerned about the repression, the police brutality, violence, the rising wave of racism that makes up the political landscape of the U.S. today. Our young people deserve a future, and I consider it the mandate of my ancestors to be a part of the struggle to ensure that they have one." Thank you very much.
This is Prison Pipeline, and you have been listening to Angela Davis on feminism and